Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I've got some news for your good to know file. Make of it what you will. The Daily Mail is reporting that autism among American children has, and teenagers, by the way, has gone up by 50% in the last 3 years. Here's what it says. The number of children in the U.S. being diagnosed with autism has rocketed in recent years, a new study finds. Researchers at Guangdong Pharmaceutical University in China found that 3.49% of U.S. children and adolescents, or around one in every 30, had autism in 2020. It's a 52% increase from the 2.29% of Utes in America, and looking at the same circumstances as of 2017. The research team did not give an exact reason for the jump. Many experts have speculated that the increase is related to parents better understanding early signs of their child's autism and more surveillance for the condition. Researchers, who published their findings yesterday in the Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics Journal, they gathered data from the National Health Interview Survey, NHIS. The survey, which is conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, conducts household interviews and targeted screenings to find out more about the health of the average household. The NHS found in 2014 that 2.24% of children and adolescents in America had autism. So to kind of connect these figures, they say that it's going from 2.24% estimated in 2014 to 3.49%. So in terms of numbers, I mean, it's not massive, but it is significant, and it represents, as they say, a 50% increase. The figure gradually grew, reaching 2.76% in 2016. Then it was a drop from 2017 to 2.44%. And then it steadily grew, it being the number of cases of autism being diagnosed. Researchers note that the U.S. and Europe generally have higher autism rates than the rest of the world, likely because of better screening and diagnosis. Nearly 5% of young boys had autism compared to just 2 under come on, I got to get it together, compared to just under 2% of girls. Let's see, black children and those who come from poverty have a more educated family are most likely to be diagnosed with autism. The reason for these discrepancies has not been determined, but experts have known that boys in particular are more likely to receive an autism diagnosis. In 2006, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommended that all children between 18 months and 2 years of age be screened for autism, and the amount of screening and diagnostic level testing has increased, and so have the number of cases that have been detected. The average parent, it says, is now more aware of common early signs of autism than they were in previous years, and could recognize things like failure to keep eye contact, poor communication skills, and inability to operate out of structure as signs. Social stigma surrounding autism has also grown, or lessened rather. Many parents are much more willing to get their child screened without fear of negative social repercussions. Some experts warn that there are some negative side effects being suffered by children in the womb that put them at higher risk. So that's interesting. And I although this story just came out yesterday, I am waiting to see to what extent there's a discussion about vaccines and whether or not, I mean, this is an age-old discussion, been around for a long time. Everybody seems to have an anecdotal story to tell. I do. I mean, for what it's worth, Nancy and I know two couples, both of whom, and this is going back many years, I'm thinking about one in particular, they had, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 children, and their little boy was, I think, maybe 5 years old, and they brought him in for routine vaccinations. It was completely normal. We knew the family. We knew the child, you know, completely like every other child. And the mother and father were convinced that getting this round of immunizations gave him or caused in some way autism, because within a matter of a couple of days, he was feeling ill and his entire personality changed. And he was diagnosed within a few months as being autistic and like really autistic. So again, anecdotal. Does it mean that there's a cause and effect relationship between vaccines and autism? I know many people, they are convinced that that's the case. And there are others, of course, who say, no, that's not scientifically verifiable. And I don't know, and I don't claim to know. But since we're seeing an increase of this nature among autism diagnoses in this country, I'm waiting to see how the debate reheats about whether or not there's any connection with vaccines. I thought you'd want to know about that. And as is true for all the stories that I share with you on this program, you can access them all by going to the show page. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and on the right side, you'll see the Twitter feed that's embedded there. And you can grab the links to the stories and evaluate them for yourselves. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Teresa in Philadelphia. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, what does the church teach on the issue of borders and immigration? And in the eyes of the church, what would a just policy look like? And the reason I'm asking is, we were at a prayer group meeting a few months back, and with immigration being so much in the news, one of the members of the prayer group suggested that Jesus would not have been for borders and would not have recognized the notion of national sovereignty. That just really got me thinking, and I realized that I have no idea what the church teaches on immigration.
Well, let's start with the fact that the church, at least in terms of the Holy See and the Vatican City State, is a sovereign nation. And so the church asserts her own sovereignty and her own borders and her own autonomy. So it would be, to my mind, foolish and ignorant for somebody to say, well, the church doesn't teach that there can be sovereign nations and borders, because the church has one of those in the form of the Holy See and the Vatican City State. So I don't think that's a plausible position for someone to take. Now, this is a vexing question that has evolved over time, certainly, and I would propose that there's no way for somebody to say, well, Jesus wouldn't approve of borders, Jesus wouldn't approve of sovereign nations. Jesus did not condemn either of those things. Now, that's an argument from silence. It doesn't mean that, in theory at least, that he may not have had, you know, some teaching on that topic, but he never enunciated it. He never condemned, for example, this idea of the Roman Empire or, for that matter, the land of Israel, which had certain borders. And there were walls that were built in the old city of Jerusalem, walls around the temple. In fact, even within the temple, you had different porticos, and the Gentiles, who obviously were the uncircumcised, they were not Jewish, but they were maybe God-fearing, they were allowed only up to a certain point, and there was a wall there with a plaque that said, if you are not Jewish, if you're a Gentile, and you go beyond this wall, you can expect to be killed. So the Jews were very conscious of partitions and places where certain people could go and other people couldn't go. The temple would be, it seems to me, highly emblematic of this. You had a section for women. You had a section for men. The Holy of Holies was partitioned off, and only the high priest could go in there, and even then he could only go in once per year. So Jesus doesn't condemn any of those things. He doesn't even hint that there's some problem in his mind with excluding certain people from certain places. Now, this, of course, this is religious in context, and I realize it's not the same thing as a nation with borders, etc. But I think there's something there that gives us an insight into why you could reject somebody's notion that Jesus would blah, 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 reject borders and nations. That's just a kind of a gimmicky argument, and there's nothing really to base it upon. Beyond that, I mean, in the absence of anything that Jesus said that on this topic, I think then we have to take a look at our current circumstances, and that is, we live in a world with nation states. It is what it is, and the church does not say that, uh-oh, you guys, you can't be doing that. You can't have, you know, sovereignty, and you can't have national borders, et cetera, et cetera. The church doesn't say any of those things. Rather, what the church says is that we should be generous and accommodating and seeking after the welfare of people who need help, especially poor people, and that includes immigrants. And so immigration, I think, is really the linchpin to this discussion, Teresa, as to how do you, on the one hand, preserve your national sovereignty and the integrity of your borders, because you can't really have a country, as people have pointed out, you can't really have a country per se if there are no borders, if there's nothing that defines the country in some geographical way as this is this country and that over there is that country. You can't even have that, much less have security or control over day-to-day affairs that happen within your borders if you don't have borders. So this leads, I think, to maybe the heart of the answer to your question. That is, the real issue is not, to my mind, borders or does the church say anything one way about one way or the other about sovereignty or autonomy, because it doesn't. It respects those things and recognizes that in justice, people have a right to govern themselves. They have a right to handle their own affairs, and people in one part of the world may look at life very differently than those in another part of the world, and they'll have certain customs and rules and mores that would reflect those views that would be different than in other parts of the world. And yet when you have people who want to move from where they are to another place to avoid violence or just have a better life, not live in poverty, maybe it's just a terrible situation, or for whatever reason, the church says that immigration is a right that human beings have. And you have that right to try to improve your circumstances if you can. And if that means moving to a different country, you have that right. So I'll kind of conclude all of this by saying the dilemma, it seems to me, is how do you, on the one hand, how are you accommodating and welcoming and solicitous for the welfare of immigrants, and at the same time, respect injustice the rights and privileges of the citizens of the country who is going to be hosting these immigrants. And having a non-existent border is not the way to do that. We have to be just to everybody. And people who are here in this country, we have a right to protection. We have a right to security. We have a right, you know, to the extent that an immigrant has a right to those things and moves to a different country to find them, we have a right to those things in this country. It's not as though people from a different country have more rights or different rights than we do. It's all the same. So that to me seems to be the dilemma. That's the headache. That's the political football, is how do we accommodate both realities? And thus far, at least, I haven't seen, you know, at least in the current circumstances, I haven't seen a lot of movement forward on that. Those are some thoughts off the cuff, Teresa. What do you think?
Okay, so yeah, that helps a lot. Thank you. And so in the eyes of the church, do you think it would be just for the United States to have, say, a limit or a number of immigrants that they would allow? And secondly, to reserve certain rights like voting for the citizens only?
I can't speak for the church. As a Catholic, as a member of the church, and I would say reasonably knowledgeable on the church's social justice teachings, you know, having read the writings of popes who have commented on such things, I think I can safely say that, yes, the church does respect that. There are those in the church, some, who I think hold an exaggerated and disproportionate and in some ways even defective view of immigration. And they would argue that the United States, for all intents and purposes, should not have any real limits, and it should just take as many people as want to come in. Now, that is effectively impossible, as you know, Teresa. I'm assuming that, you know, that you would feel like I do on this issue. It's effectively impossible because our infrastructure and sources of food and water and electricity, in many respects, are already, you know, taxed beyond the breaking point, just like a Texas with their power outages and things like that. So it's not as though we have unlimited resources. We don't. And so to be prudent and to be just, it requires certain I don't know. I think limits is the right word for it. There have to be certain limits, certain parameters, so that you can accommodate that. And I'll go back to the Vatican City State as an example. The Holy See, as the sovereign entity, it too has these measures and controls. You can't just go move into Vatican City State. If you decided, you know what, I love the weather in Rome. It's very picturesque, a lot of great food. I want to immigrate to the Vatican City State. You don't have that ability because they will say, no, you can't. You can't move here. We don't have the space. We don't have enough of everything. And by the way, Teresa, if you wanted to move here, think of all the other people who'd want to move here. And so, no, you can't. You're not allowed to. So my question is, if it's true, and I think it's, you know, it's self-evidently smart for the Vatican City State to do that, why is it not okay for other countries to do that? Some might argue, well, because the United States is vastly bigger than Vatican City State. That's true, but the principle still applies because it's a matter of scale. So if it's reasonable and appropriate for the Vatican City State to say, no, we don't have the resources, we don't have the ability to handle an influx of people who just want to move here just because, well, the same principle would apply to any country, including this country. So if I had the discussion with the lady you're talking about, I would probably be bringing up some of these issues.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I, you know, it's not a topic we often get a chance to dig into. So thank you for raising that question. Appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Gracie in Chandler, Arizona. Hi, Gracie.
Hello, Patrick.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to let you know that about 5 years ago, I was living in California, and I had to babysit a 45-year-old for a friend, and he was autistic. And okay. When I was babysitting him, I noticed that there were pictures of him when he was like about 1 or 2 years old, you know, just normal. And when she came back, me and my curiosity, I asked her, and she said, she was Philippine. And she said she was getting ready to go visit her family at the Philippines at his age, at two years old, but he had to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And they gave him all his vaccines, and in the airplane, he started changing.
See, Gracie, if I can interrupt, I know where you're going with this, and that's why I said everybody's got an anecdotal story. Everybody knows somebody, it seems, like mm-hmm. you do, who believes yeah. that the vaccine caused the autism. I'm well aware
okay.
of it. Yeah. And I bet, Gracie, we're not going to do this. We're not going to have a show on vaccines. We're not going to have a show on autism. I just wanted to bring up that information. But if we did, you know, in a parallel universe, if we did that, I guarantee you for the next 3 hours, we'd have nonstop calls of people with the exact same kind of story. And then we'd also have some calls of people who'd be angry about that and saying, no, the science says that there's no correlation between vaccines and autism. It would be a big brouhaha. But
yeah,
I understand where you're coming
fair
from.
Enough, but I do believe that, you know, but at least we should at least put everything on the table and let everybody choose for themselves. That's what I believe in. And it did, you know, kind of wake me up. And that's one yeah. of the reasons why I'm calling and letting you know.
Yeah. Any other reasons that we can cover before I have to take a break?
No, that's it.
Okay. Well, hey, it's nice to talk to you. I'm a big, big fan of Chandler, Arizona. It's one of my favorite places
yes.
in the U.S.
I love it here.
You got it
I
made
it
in Chandler. Yes. All right. Well, say hello to the rest of Chandler for me, please. I look forward to getting back there one of these days, although in the cold weather months, of course. I'll be right back right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Hello. Hello again.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. real life solutions you can believe in. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. The number again, 888-914-9149. Before we go to the phones, a couple of quick emails. This one comes in from Diana, and Diana's listening in Austin on 970 AM. Hello, Diana. Thanks for writing to me. She says, just because of COVID, the wine blood of Christ is no longer served at Mass. I think this is terrible. Fair enough, Diana. I know some people who hold that view. I'm not one of them, though. And since you brought it up, I'll raise my reasons for that. When you understand, and maybe you do, so I'm just going to say this for the benefit of anybody who might not understand, the reality of the Holy Eucharist at Mass, transubstantiation, when what once was bread and wine is transubstantiated into the very body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus, which becomes substantially, sacramentally, really and truly present, but under the appearances of that same bread and wine. So the bread and the reality of the bread and the wine are gone and have been replaced by the real presence of Christ. But the appearances of bread and wine remain. So to our senses, there's no change. You don't see any difference. You don't taste any difference. Everything about bread and wine that was true before the consecration is, from a physical standpoint, based upon what our senses can see, it's the same. But the reality is that now Jesus is truly present there in the manner that I just said. So that's the church's teaching. But what that means is that even if you had only the slightest little piece of a consecrated host, you receive all of Jesus, all of him, body, blood, soul, divinity. You're not lacking anything. It's not as though you've only received only half of Holy Communion. You receive all of Jesus in his entirety, glorified, resurrected, in that tiny piece of host. And similarly, if you were to receive only a small sip of the precious blood, the same thing is true. So the giving of both kinds, both the host and the precious blood to lay people, which for most of the church's history in the West, in any case, in the Latin Rite Church, has not been the custom. And I'll give a reason or two why that was the case. But for the moment, I'll just say that it wasn't the custom in the church until very recently. And really, it was from Vatican II on that that began to be much more prevalent. And now it was, you know, nearly universal in most Catholic parishes. But it wasn't the organic liturgical development of this custom over the centuries. But my point in saying that is that the symbolism, which is very important, is heightened, no question about it, when you receive both the host, the Holy Eucharist, in the form of the what once was bread, and the precious blood. So there's no doubt about it that the symbolism of eating and drinking the body and the blood of the Lord, as St. Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, there's no question that this is an important symbol. However, part of the problem is because some people, and I don't know if you're one of them, Diana, maybe you're not, but some people are of the mistaken notion that unless you receive both, you haven't received all of Jesus, or that there's something substandard, or there's something less, or something missing, or something inferior if you only receive the host and not the precious blood. And none of those things are true, which leads me to one of the practical reasons why the Catholic Church, for the longest time, at least in the Latin Rite Church, this is not true. Here's a little cul-de-sac in my commentary here. In the Eastern Orthodox churches and in the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, take the Byzantine Rite, for example, it is the custom there to commingle the Eucharistic bread with the wine in the chalice and then spoon that into the mouth of the person coming up to receive Holy Communion. Never in the hands, never, ever, ever, ever in the hands in the Eastern churches, but they do commingle the two species, the Eucharistic bread and the precious blood, into one that's served to you. In the Latin Rite, that's not how it was done. In the Latin Rite, one of the practical reasons for this was known as the The Utre, I had to stop and think of the term here. The Utraquist heresy. And you may say, the what heresy? Utraquist, it is in English, it's an anglicization of the Latin phrase for both and. And it entailed this mistaken notion that you weren't receiving all of Jesus unless you received both and, both the host and the precious blood. And that's not true. And it completely goes against the church's teaching on the Holy Eucharist. So as a matter of trying to help people not fall into that mistaken notion of both and, the Utraquist heresy, for all intents and purposes, the church restricted lay people to receiving only the host. Now you may say, well, why just lay people? Well, because the priest, he is the altar Christus. He is standing at the altar and acting in the person of Christ. And as you look at the Last Supper, you see that Jesus said to those very first priests, the very first bishops, indeed, the apostles, he said to take the and eat the bread and drink of the cup, the chalice. And it's proper for the priest to do so because not only is he a priest, but also he is acting in the person of Christ, who did consume both the bread and the wine, which he transubstantiated, of course. So that's the distinction for why the priest would do that, and we can say by extension also deacons, but the theology of the Eucharist does not require that any person, any lay person, receive both and. There are other practical reasons, like the transmission of germs, and this is even well before germ theory, and even scientifically understanding what a germ was or that they even existed. There was some dim recognition that it was not healthy for masses of people to be drinking from a common cup. But in any case, those are my thoughts. I'm glad you raised the question, Diana. And I have a feeling that given COVID, quite frankly, and everything that we went through, I have a feeling that we're not likely to see a return anytime soon to receiving communion under both kinds across the board. It may be true in some places. Some parishes may have reinstituted it. But I think as a general phenomenon, we're not likely to see it come back anytime soon. I could be wrong, but that's my take on it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Lorraine now in Buffalo, Minnesota. Good morning, Lorraine.
Hi, I'm a grandma, and I'm also Catholic. My question is, my granddaughter is having their little girl baptized on Sunday. Am I allowed to go to the baptism in a Lutheran church?
So your granddaughter...
They're now Lutheran. Granddaughter has changed from Catholic to Lutheran.
Okay, so let me slow you down here. So your granddaughter changed from Catholic to Lutheran, or her parents changed and they're raising her as a Lutheran? Or both?
She did herself. She's an adult.
Yeah. Oh, so your granddaughter's an adult and she was never baptized?
Yes, she was in the Catholic Church, and for her husband's sake, she turned Lutheran, and now they have a little one they want to baptize plan on baptizing in the Lutheran Church. Am I allowed to go to it or attend it?
Well, it's not a yes or no answer. That's why I was asking those questions, Lorraine. So your daughter has left the church, and she left as an adult and became Lutheran. And now the person being baptized, the child, is a little baby. Is that right?
That's right. Their daughter.
Okay. Okay. Baby. Well, okay. So here's the way I can answer that question. Yes, you can go to this, but for this reason, because the baptism is almost without a doubt going to be valid. So it's not a question of invalidity the way a wedding would be. If a Catholic...
Right, okay.
Well, hear me out here, Lorraine. There's a couple nuances I want to share with you, okay?
Okay.
So unlike a wedding where if a Catholic leaves the church or just ignores the church and doesn't get married according to the church's canonical form, the church law says that that's an invalid wedding. And that leads into the question of, well, should I go to that? Will it be scandalous if I go because it's invalid? You don't have to worry about that kind of an issue here, because the Lutheran Church is known for validly baptizing people. Even though they're wrong about many other things, they do that right. So that leads to this nuance that I want to share with you. that as St. Paul says in the Epistle to the Ephesians, there's one faith, one Lord, one baptism. And what that means is there is no such thing as a Lutheran baptism or a Baptist baptism or a Calvary Chapel baptism and a Catholic baptism. There's only baptism. And if it's celebrated validly under any circumstances, as long as you have valid form and water, or valid form and matter, rather, so saying, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit and water and the intention to baptize, it's valid. So what that means is that if you go to this, even though it's a crying shame that your daughter has left the church and gone into Lutheranism, that's a whole problem unto itself, but that's not your problem when it comes to attending your granddaughter's baptism, because that's a good and holy thing in itself that she's being baptized. It's problematic that she's going to now be raised in a church that is rife with certain heresies, but again, separate issue. But for your purposes, to be able to go in good conscience and be present to see her being baptized, you can. You wouldn't be doing anything sinful. And I realize it's a bit more of an answer than maybe you wanted, but I wanted to give you the reasons why it would be different in this case than it would be, say, going to a wedding. Does that make sense?
I understand. Real good. Oh, yes, a lot. A lot
okay.
of sense.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I could help, Lorraine. And for what it's worth, if you want to pick up a book by Tim Drake, it's called There We Stood, Here We Stand. It's a collection of testimonies of former Lutherans, many of whom were ministers. In fact, now that I think about it, they all might have been Lutheran ministers. But they tell their story of why they became Catholic. And so perhaps you could find a moment where you could give a copy of that book to your daughter and just say, you know what, here's some food for thought, something to think about as you proceed in life. And maybe she will look back later and thank you and say, that made all the difference, and I've come home to the Catholic Church. So give it a try. Let's go now to Melissa. And thank you, Lorraine. Let's go to Melissa in Milwaukee. Hi, I almost said hi, Milwaukee. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Hi, Patrick. So I'm calling on behalf of my mom. Last night, she's very devout Catholic, does daily rosary, says the long form St. Michael prayer. So she's really been growing in her faith. We got confirmed in 2018 together. And so we did RCIA. So last night she sent me a picture because she was taking her vitamins and her smart water turned to what looks like blood. Okay. And I don't know if there's anything we should do. I mean, obviously she's like, I would never, you know, make up anything to do with God. I can't believe this. I'm crying. I don't know what it means. And then this morning I called her to be like, hey, like, how'd you sleep? Mm-hmm. You think any more on it? Like, she did the litany to the precious blood and the litany to the sacred heart last night as well. Then just in Thanksgiving, it's the month of the precious blood of Jesus. So yeah, I was like, I don't know what really, if there's any protocol or if we just say, thank you, Lord. So yeah, I don't know if you've ever heard of such a thing.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've heard such things that range everything from actual authentic miracles to people who just, they get, you know, they're startled because something that has a purely natural explanation at first seems mysterious. So my presumption, Melissa, is that this is almost certainly something like that. It's not impossible that it could be a supernatural phenomenon, but the likelihood of that, I think, is pretty low. More likely, rather, would be that maybe something in one of the vitamins interacted with the water that way. And
right.
Smart water
she
has...
tried that this morning, apparently. Mm-hmm. She does have a few vitamins, and she's put them. They've been in the water for over an hour, and nothing's happened, whereas this was, like, instantaneous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very interesting detail. I don't know what to make of it myself, but if she really wanted to know, what is this water? You know, why is it turning this color? I mean, it would be a bit of an expense, but you can find labs where they can evaluate that kind of thing. Even like a, you know, maybe a local chemistry teacher at the local high school. Hey, this happened. Can you apply your scientific knowledge to this and see if you can test it to see why it's turned purple or red? And what is the content? You know, what are the chemicals in this water? And I'm certain that if it's actual blood, I mean, he's going to be able to tell that, or she'll be able to tell that really quickly. If it's not, then what does it mean? Is it just a symbol of that? Okay. You know, what does that mean exactly? Then you start looking for, well, why would God do something like that? We don't always know with certitude, but I would take first things in order, and maybe the first thing I would do is see if a local chemistry professor could take a look at it and make some sense out of it.
I like that idea. Yeah, I figured if there was anybody, I was driving to an appointment, and I thought, I was like listening to you, and I thought, hey, I bet Patrick Madrid might know, and then I got through for the first time ever. So I was like, well, cool, this will answer my question.
I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did, Melissa. Thank you for that. And do me a favor. I'd like to know. You know, whatever it turns out to be, I'd like to know. So call me back, please.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye. When I come back, I'll tell you a quick story about when I was in a chemistry class in high school. I think you might find it interesting. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I promised you just a little story for what it's worth. When I was getting close to 16 or thereabouts, I really, really, really wanted to get my driver's license, as 16-year-olds tend to want to do. And it just so happens that I was a lazy student in high school, lazy in the sense that I didn't try, didn't really work in the subjects that I didn't like, and I didn't like math, and I didn't like science, and I just didn't try. So I routinely got C's and D's in those classes. And as you can imagine, that didn't make my parents very happy. I got A's in other classes that I liked. I liked foreign languages, and I liked history, and I liked things of that nature. And I would get easy A's on those classes, but the ones that were difficult, I didn't try. Much to my detriment. I wish I had. I look back on it with regret. But that's the context for what happened. Because when I asked my dad if I could go get my driver's license, he was shrewd and a student of human nature, or at least my human nature. And he said, sure, you can get your driver's license, but only under the provision that you get an A in chemistry, because that was the class, that was the upcoming class, or maybe it was the class that I was already in that semester. And he said, you have to get an A in chemistry, not an A minus, not a B plus. You have to get an A. If you get an A, you can get your driver's license. If you don't get an A, then you have to wait for the next semester and get an A in that next science class. So for me, this was like him telling me I had to fly to the moon or something like that. Just impossible. But I did it. And I did it because I wanted the driver's license more than I didn't want to study. And I don't remember exactly now what it took, but I remember just buckling down and saying, okay, I'm going to study this. I'm going to learn it. I'm going to at least learn it well enough that I could pass the tests. And I did. And I proved to myself that something that I didn't like to do, I could do and would do if I needed to do that. So that lesson actually helped me in many other ways in my life. But I got my driver's license. And I really thank my dad, because it was a double whammy in a good sense. I got my license and I also got an A, which brought my grade point average up. And that wasn't bad. So there's that. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to San Diego and talk to Jim. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Patrick. I want to point out that you're giving some tragic misinformation. While everything you say with regard to receiving the whole Jesus Christ under either form is true, you are neglecting the fact that Matthew records that Jesus said to his disciples. Jesus did not say to the apostles, according to Matthew. Thus, they were not yet ordained. That took place later after the resurrection, when Jesus breathed on them and said, receive the Holy Spirit.
Negatory, good buddy. That's not true. The apostles were ordained, the church teaches, to the priesthood at the Last Supper, and they were granted the authority to forgive sins by Jesus in John chapter 20, beginning in verse 20, when he breathed on them and said that. So, no, that is incorrect information that you're purveying there.
Hello? Hello.
Did you have more you wanted to say, Jim?
Yes, absolutely. One, I want to know where the church teaches that they were ordained there. I want to see that in a church document asserting that.
Okay, I can help you with that, Jim. I can't give it to you right off the cuff because that would require digging into Denzinger, but I can do that for you. But that being the case, I mean, if we want to quibble over that issue, what is the real point you want to make? That you think it's better to receive communion under both kinds or what?
Hello?
All right. I don't know what's going on with Jim's line, but maybe he can't hear me for some reason. Jim, try calling back because for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to be working on this line. Thank you. We'll go to Jim now, a different Jim in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Patrick, I have a question. My goddaughter is getting married in December, but she's not getting married in a Catholic church, and she is, from what I understand, not even being married by a Catholic priest. And I'm pretty sure she went through communion and confirmation, but apparently she has not stuck with the Catholic faith.
Okay.
So should I attend the wedding in good faith, or what's your advice?
Well, I mean, if she's not getting married in the Catholic church, then no, I wouldn't advise that because it would be an invalid marriage. So she's Catholic, right? She's Catholic and she's received her sacraments.
Before.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, I mean, if she's just abandoning her responsibilities as a Catholic and getting married at the golf course or at the beach or something, the church says that unless she receives permission from the bishop, it's an invalid marriage. So, especially as her godfather, you have a standing in her life as somebody who's promised to, you know, to be there to help guide her in the right direction. It seems to me that attending this wedding would not be fulfilling that objective, as painful as that would be.
Yeah, I have to figure out a way to kind of convey that message. You know, I haven't actually been the best godfather, so, you know, mm-hmm. I kind of regret that, but you know, we've kind of moved away and grown apart, you know.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But, yeah,
I realize.
Okay, I kind of figured that.
Mm-hmm. All I was going to say, Jim, is that I realize how painful and difficult these situations are, so I don't want to underestimate that end of it. But at the same time, I mean, I recognize there are people, there are even priests, who in good faith would say, go ahead and go, tell her why this is wrong, but go anyway. That I can't follow that calculus, though, because, I mean, if it's wrong, then if you go, it gives the appearance that you're condoning something that you believe is wrong. And I come back to the analogy that I've used before with St. John the Baptist. You know why he was in jail was because he was publicly rebuking King Herod for living in an invalid marriage. He had married his brother's wife. And so I think about St. John the Baptist when this comes up. Yeah. And so he probably could have skated if King Herod had said to him, can you just like knock it off? And okay, I realize you hold this view. Okay, I get it. But can you just like, could you come to the wedding? Could you come to the reception? You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. But just for the sake of keeping the lines of communication open, just for the sake of, you know, me not cutting your head off, could you come to the wedding reception? And I can't picture St. John the Baptist saying, okay, I'll go. So for me, that's kind of a sticking point.
I do appreciate it, Patrick, and I thank you for everything you do.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it, and I hope there will be some graceful and non-painful way to let her know this. And who knows, maybe this, and this is what I always hope for, maybe this will be an opportunity for you to be a fully functioning godfather and really help her to come back to a practice of her faith. I mean, that's your role in her life in any case. So this is one of those moments where you may be able to accomplish that.
Yep. I will pray for that.
All right.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Let's go. Let's see. Time? Yeah, we have time. Let's go back to Jim. You made it back, Jim. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. Hey, let me make very clearly the first point. if the apostles had already been ordained, why did Jesus call them disciples rather than apostles? For in Matthew, I think it's very clear, he said to his disciples, we are all
his
disciples.
Which passage are you looking at? Let's
Matthew,
look at it together.
Matthew at the Last Supper.
Hey, Jim, easy, big fella. You don't have to yell. I'm just asking a question. I want to make sure that I'm looking at the same text you are.
I'm sorry. I thought I was still talking to your caller.
No, it's me.
I mean, your first row. Okay. Oh, I'm on the air. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was the passage that we want to look at?
Matthew at the Last Supper. Matthew's account.
Yes. What do you have Jesus it in front say? Of you? Do you have it in front
Not
of you?
Not this moment, but I have. I can get it.
Oh, so can I. So I can do the same thing. So let's open to, let's see. Let's look at Matthew chapter 26, verse 29. I want to go to the section where he addresses them. So we're in Matthew chapter 26.
Exactly.
And let's see here. Okay, now on the let's start in verse 20, shall we? Okay, no. Let's start early because that's where the word disciples appears. Okay, so let's start in verse 17.
Right.
Now, on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at the table with the 12. This is now the apostles. It's not all the disciples.
Excuse me. The 12 does not say they are apostles. It says the 12, his select group, as you've described them in other places, in other
that
times.
That the term the 12 is a synonym for the 12 apostles. That's who it's referring to.
Please keep reading.
Happy to. Your argument is going down in flames, so I'll be happy to do it.
Excuse me, you did not have the words apostles. It's your assumption that is a synonym.
It is an assumption that is based upon the evidence that the term the 12 refers to those particular 12 men. It doesn't refer to any other...
Yes, indeed. The question is...
Okay, Jim, we're not going to do it this way. If you want to talk over me, we're not going to do this. If you want to have a discussion,
okay,
we can
ahead.
Do that.
My apologies.
Thank you. So he says when he's reclining at the table with the 12, and as they were eating, he said, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, is it I, Lord? He answered, he who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. Judas, who would betray him, answered, is it I, Rabbi? He said to him, you have said so. Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them saying, drink it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in the Father's kingdom. So there we have the word disciples, and we also have the phrase the 12. And so my point to you, Jim, is that these are not mutually exclusive. They're not two different groups of people. And the apostles were indeed disciples of Jesus, but they had a special role as apostles. But it wouldn't be incorrect to refer to them as disciples because in a broader sense, they were his disciples. So I'll throw it back to you.
Except, Patrick, the recording of Jesus' actual words is he said to his disciples. This was something that years ago, not here, but other places, for example, after he had the thing in... I don't remember whether it's Mark or Matthew, where he expressed the fact that Peter would be the rock on which he'd build his church. And then later, he gave the
Matthew
same
16,
much of the
18.
Same commission to all the apostles, the rest of the the rest of the 12.
I can tell you where that is. So the first instance is in Matthew 16, 18, where he speaks to Peter individually. And then in Matthew 18, 18, he speaks to the apostles as a group, speaking to all of them together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a bit of history about me. For years, I was frustrated that when he gave the same commission, most of the same commission, not exactly and not all of it, when he gave it to the rest of the apostles, the scripture records that he gave it to his disciples. And that frustrated me for years, you know, because it made it more difficult to distinguish that it was to the 12, to the specific people who became apostles later. Well, I finally figured it out in Matthew. And as to your argument, as to what the church teaches, I would remind you that at Mass, every day, every Mass I attend, the priest says, Jesus said to his disciples, take and eat. Jesus said to his disciples, take and drink.
Jim, I don't know what you think you're proving by that. I mean, if you're arguing for communion under both kinds, the church already permits that. But if you're arguing for it's mandatory that lay people receive under both kinds, then I think you're confused and you're leaning way too heavily on a term that is open to multiple different meanings. And you're assigning one and only one meaning to it. And that's incorrect.
Patrick, may I explain?
Please.
I'm not arguing against the church. I'm arguing against your claim that the disciples had already been made into priests.
No, okay, you're not arguing against my claim. What I said is that the church teaches that at the Last Supper, that's where the apostles were ordained priests. It was in that context.
Exactly.
Right. Well, Jim, I'm not sure where else to go with this one. But I appreciate your passion. I don't agree with you, but I appreciate your giving me a call. Thank you. All right, hour two about to start. So please give me a call if you're interested. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I'll take on all comers. Just wait and see.